words can be tyrants. Their content, their implications, driving us towards unwarranted conclusions. One such word is the noun city. Every one of us knows what a city is. Therefore, presumably, every one of us knows just what a city ought to be and what the remedies are for our present urban crisis. And the word city has been around for a long time. I'm sure that if I searched the scripture, I could find 1,000 references to ear, to city. And some of them might provide quite apt descriptions of the tensions, the quality of life in the center of some of our modern cities. Take this observation of Job's. From out of the populous city, men groan, and the sound of the wounded cries out. And familiarity breeds confidence. Confidence is a very dangerous perspective for those who live in a revolutionary age. But the truth of the matter is that the only similarity between Cleveland and the historic city, between our town, any technologically oriented community, 1969, and the cities of history, all the cities until this generation, is the simple fact they represent dense agglomerations of people in a limited geographic area. Ancient Athens, Paris of La Belle Époque, Imperial Rome, Imperial London, all these towns were essentially places of the privilege and places of power. It was here that the well-born and the well-to-do drew together in order to be close to one another to carry out the essential responsibilities of the management of the country, in order to oversee their political and financial investments, and in order to provide for themselves the necessary servants and services which a life of wealth and leisure believes itself to require. The ancient city was always a city of classes, of the ins and of the outs. The ancient city was always a consumer economy. It depended upon an agricultural surplus developed by the countryside. It depended upon the tolls and tariffs of trade. And if there was no such economic surplus for it to feed on, if it could not be a parasite, the ancient city ceased to be. It was fundamentally non-productive. And being a place of power and a place of wealth, it was also a hothouse of culture. And culture, the museums, the libraries, the schools of the ancient cities, of the historic city, were essentially kept women. They existed for the pleasure and the benefit of the privileged, and not because they necessarily served the common good. Let me illustrate all of this by speaking for a moment of ancient Athens. We think of ancient Athens as the very model of a democratic poli, of a democratic community. But in fact, less than half the people who lived within ancient Athens were citizens, Athenians, belonging to the commune. The rest were metics, foreigners who were allowed to live because they performed certain craft services, because they were willing to engage in the trades, and the servants and the slaves who day by day brought in the surplus from the countryside, brought up the goods from Piraeus, from the port, for the pleasure and the luxury of the wealth. As we all know, there were great political struggles within the community of Athens. But they were always struggles within the citizenry. As far as the servants and the slaves were concerned, they may as well not have been. They were not considered. They were not seen. Athens depended upon the wealth of the Attic countryside and upon the tariff and the toils of a maritime empire. And when Plato considered in disinterested splendor the beauties of justice or peace, he did so because he was provided for by the labor, by the sweat, and the anguish of many others, because he was a citizen and they were slaves. And not unexpectedly, the philosopher king of his ideal state is a man who never sullies his hands with manual labor, never engages in trade or manufacture. And even such a cultivated gentleman as Aristotle, the prince of philosophers, believed that a slave was nothing more than a living tool. So the historic city, the city up till the 20th century, was a place of class privilege, was a power center, it was a consumer economy, it was a fragile, parasitic state, and went into the countryside when the people could no longer provide it with the surplus which on which it fed, the city simply disappeared. Read the history of Europe in the 8th and 9th and 10th centuries of this era, and you'll find that once the Muslim conquests had cut the trade routes to the west, to the east, once the Norman incursions had disrupted the countryside and trade, once a kind of primitive agriculture had destroyed the productivity of the lands, the forest lands of Europe newly cleared, once the countryside and trade could no longer provide the surplus, the cities of Europe simply ceased to be. They were no longer. And only after a number of centuries, the 12th and 13th and 14th centuries, when trade was resumed, when the countrysides were more intelligently farmed, when the surplus was again prevalent, only then did the city, as we know it, begin to emerge or re-emerge. Now, what are the similarities and what are the differences between Cleveland and Athens, between Cleveland and any historic city? Athens was a consumer economy. It was a parasite state. Cleveland is a productive economy. Cleveland produces more goods and services for the countryside and the country than it requires from the country. Of course, we need agriculture. We need to eat. And our factories and our brain industry produce more real wealth than we consume. The city now, for the first time in history, is the place where the prosperity and the wealth of a nation are essentially formed. The city is here to stay. Athens was an aristocratic economy. Athens was a polity of the well-born. Cleveland still is a polity of the privileged, but power is more widely divided. And Cleveland is on the track which every American city is following, in which we are becoming populist. Increasingly, power is going down to the grassroots. It is no longer easy to point to one man or 10 men or one corporation or 10 corporations or one political grouping or another which can make the decisions which determine the course of history. When Athens decided to build a great theater into the bank of the Acropolis, and when it found that there were a number of squatters and tents on that hillside, it simply sent in the soldiers and evicted them. There was a decision, there was power, there was action. 100 years ago, when the council and the mayor of New York decided to evict the squatters from the land which is now Central Park, they simply ordered it to be so, the police went in, and Central Park was cleared. When the mayor of Cleveland wants simply to build public housing upon empty land, he finds that he is met by political challenge. The neighborhood rises in indignation. There are threatened lawsuits. There is delay. He cannot even do such a simple thing without going to the people with his program, trying to establish it reasonably. Power no longer is concentrated in any one place in our city. And if you want to see the measurement of this displacement of power, remember how they used to say a generation ago, you can't fight City Hall? It was said with a shrug, which implied that it was, once a decision has been made, there was nothing the average citizen can do. Today, when someone says, you can't fight City Hall, it's a challenge. Take up the placards, Go down and sit in the mayor's office, get the headlines in the paper, and you'll find that there are ways to make the city, its power, its authority, change its mind. The modern city is set on an irreversible course in which power is being bled from its traditional establishment place and is being slowly passed down to those groups who claim or who do in fact represent the neighborhoods, groups, the ordinary people. It is they who ultimately will have authority. What I'm saying is simply this. Most of us continue to look upon the city as if it were a familiar thing. And we bring to the city many of the attitudes and prejudices which our fathers and grandfathers and ancestors brought to cities historically. And most of these prejudices, most of these attitudes are false and misleading. And much of the failure of the so far attempted solutions to the urban crisis, I believe, can be traced directly to the fact that very few of us have accepted the simple proposition that the city, our city, is a radical new creation. That it is something which has never existed before. And it requires a radically new orientation of mind in order to deal with its problems. Marshall McLuhan said something in another respect which capsules what I've been trying to say so far. He said, very few men look at the present with present eyes. They tend to miss the present by translating it into the past, seeing it through a rear view mirror. Now, what do we see when we look through a rear view mirror? The city traditionally was a place of noise, of the maddening crowd, of confusion. It was a place of prosperity for the few, and therefore of jaded tastes. It was a place in which so many stimuli were sent out to the average citizen that he really ceased to be able to think, to judge, to measure, to weigh, to balance. And so traditionally, when men have needed to be philosophic, get a perspective on their condition, they have gone to the countryside to find solitude, to find peace of mind, the quiet of contemplation. If you read the commentaries on scriptures of the ancients, you'll find that whenever they deal with the interesting question of why God chose the wilderness of Sinai, of all places, in order to reveal the law, that they suggest that he chose this precisely because it was wilderness. It was empty space. Here man was alone. If God had gone into the agora, into the marketplace of a city-state in the ancient world and revealed his law there, there would have been the shouting of the hawkers in the market stalls. There would have been the police tramping back and forth, shouting out the town crier's news. There had been all kinds of noise and confusion. No one would have bothered to stop to listen. But in the countryside, in quiet, we listen to the inner voice. Revelation reveals itself. Now, all of us look, I think, at the city with this particular rear-view mirror. Whenever we become jaded, whenever our ears cease to listen, wherever we know that we've been overwhelmed by work, that we're overtired, that we're not responding intelligently anymore, we leave. We look for the green places. We go to the countryside. And each of us, in one way or another, builds a little retreat in the countryside for quiet and for peace of mind. But the countryside is finite, and there are 3 billion earthlings. And soon we find that the countryside is filled with our transistors and our noisy car horns and all of the sounds of the city, and there is no sylvan quiet anymore. Suburbia simply doesn't work in an overpopulated world, and exurbia, the countryside, works even less. But instead of concentrating on finding ways of building quiet into the city, of building apartments which are not simply jerry-built, where every sound travels from room to room and from place to place, of building places where there are rooms which are open to the air but shut out to the noise of the city. Instead of building parks around our city where a person can go and find the sunshine and find the peace and the open space, we concentrate simply on the business, the frenzy of living in the city. We build without thought to our human needs. And we assume that there'll be enough peace in the countryside always to provide for that need. We look at the world through, we look at our cities through a rear view mirror. And this view distorts what we see. Looking at the city through a rear view mirror, we become convinced that what we need to do to renew our cities is to do what men have always done when cities needed to be renewed. The old imperial response. You build bigger highways, broad boulevards. You build monumental central structures. You build palaces of high culture. You build at least a facade to the living quarters of the city so men won't question what kind of dismal living and poverty exist beyond the central streets. You rebuild the city, presumably with brick and with mortar. You remember 4 or 5 years, maybe 6 years ago, when Cleveland State University was first announced, one of the editors of one of our papers decided that here was found money which could be used to build the pet project of his pet project, which would stimulate the cultural excitement of the city and be a major building block in its renewal. And what was his pet project? He saw the chance to build a great Cleveland opera house. And God knows that the public hall is an acoustic monstrosity. And certainly an opera house, a music hall of quality and beauty would be of advantage to many of us. But certainly if anyone were laying out the priorities of urban renewal, an opera house for the city of Cleveland stands at rock bottom, the last thing that needs to be done, not the first. But many of us look upon urban renewals have the privileged classes of every age. In terms of building a fine symphony hall, of enlarging the museum, of building the opera house, of building the palaces of culture. Now, this was fine in the patrician society, in the city of old, and they're lovely to have. But in the modern city, we must deal with ordinary human beings and ordinary human needs and their requirements, not the requirements of a class which has lost control, the reins of power. And even those of us who are not to the manner born have a habit of looking upon our city and of developing plans for the city which are simply brick and mortar plans, which look upon the solution of the city in building. We look to build new schools, we look to build new recreation centers, we look to build new multiple health centers, we look to build broader streets, we look to build mass transportation, and we assume that in this building, we will somehow find the solution to the urban crisis. Now, nothing I say today should be construed as saying that the rabbi does not believe that all these programs are not necessary. They are, and they are urgent. But what I would suggest today, with every bit of persuasion of which I'm capable, is that no building project as such will touch the fundamental problems of the city, because these problems are human and not building. You can live in a drafty room, and if you feel yourself useful, you're going to be a useful citizen. You can live with inadequate food, you write a great novel, and make a fine contribution to the city. All that our urban renewal building programs will be to build better walls, greater shelter, and it's necessary. But it won't rebuild human beings. And it's men whom we must teach ourselves and others to live in the city. It's new emotional dimensions, it's new emotional and spiritual requirements. We must learn how to maintain citizenship in a place thronging with people. We must learn how to live with a certain degree of violence without becoming violent in response. We must learn the job skills that are necessary in an urban job market. We must learn how to budget our time and budget our energies and budget our citizenship and really be of service to our community. And these lessons are not easily learned. I remember vividly the testimony which was offered a year ago to the Mayor's Commission on Public Welfare. We heard from the experts, and we heard from citizens. And the difference was shocking. The educators spoke to us of new schools, centrally located educational centers, multi-purpose educational centers, parents spoke to us, smaller class size, of more sensitive teachers, of more teachers, of a more flexible curriculum. The social workers spoke to us of raising the level of maintenance, subsistence monies. The clients spoke to us of more sensitive caseworkers, of people who would lift up their heads from the multiple forms which had to be filled and listen to their problems and offer them immediate, concrete suggestions. The city planner spoke to us of low-cost housing. The city dweller spoke to us of twice-a-week garbage collection, of rat control, of safety on the streets. Now, allowing every pianissimo that you want, which begins with the simple fact that all of us are more annoyed by niggling problems which face us, and we sometimes are short-sighted and lose sight of the larger issue. Assuming all that, it yet remains that what these people were saying to us is not that they didn't want the new houses and the new schools and the higher level of subsistence, but that in terms of living in the city, what they required was a new relationship with the professionals who are responsible for many of these programs, a new sense of partnership in the institutions which are their institutions, the recreation centers, the opportunity centers, the school, the city government. What they want, in fact, is a sense of belonging. They want to feel part of and partially responsible for and not catered to. The tragedy of our cities today is that we are still acting as if we're looking at the past and not the future, as if we can authorize by fiat and impose by law and solve by authority, by expertise, the problems of our city. I don't know what else the riots in Cleveland and Detroit and Watts and Washington prove, but they prove this to me, that no one can any longer simply order by bureaucratic decree or by city hall authority or by industrial leverage this and this and this as the remedy for the city and assume that because it seems reasonable, it will be effective and it will be abided. The people have said, we will do what we want to do, what we feel must be done, but you will not tell us, order us, force us to do it. Just a few weeks ago, I read, as many of you did in the papers, of Roxbury near Boston, Massachusetts. Roxbury is a teeming black slum. Its great problem is unemployment. 35% of the adult males in Roxbury are out of a job. And so well-intentioned city and state and federal city planners and job specialists got together, and they finally prevailed on one industry to build a plant in the community of Roxbury on the promise that all the employment at the worker level and at middle management level would be given over to those who lived around the plant. And the government gave certain tax credits to the business to build this new factory, and all seemed to be going well. And the factory, the land was raised, and the factory was built, and when it opened its door to hire people, it found outside its door a revolving group of pickets from the local neighborhood. No one had ever bothered to go into that neighborhood and to ask the mothers there how much the heavy trucks coming to that factory would interfere with their children walking to the elementary school next door. No one had bothered to go into the neighborhood and to say, is this where the factory should be built? Are these the slums that ought to be torn down? Or perhaps should we put it someplace else, not in a residential area, not so close to schools and to a library where the noise will interfere with your children at work, study, and at play? People simply will not accept the castor oil when a doctor says it's good for you. They've got to convince themselves of it. That's the fact of life in a city today. But most of our governmental institutions and most of our practices still insist on telling the people what's good for them. The taxes are taken from Cleveland, and they go to the county, they go to Columbus, they go to Washington, And there some expert decides how much shall come back to Cleveland and for what projects. And though there has been a proliferation of grassroots organizations in the last few years, these are now, as you know, threatened by the philosophy of the new administration, because inevitably these neighborhood groups organize around complaints, something which City Hall, something which the county commissioners, something which the state government is not doing. Otherwise, people go along from day to day without political structure. Inevitably, they are organized in opposition to, and they become embarrassments to the present way of doing things. Now, I'm a rabbi and an historian and not a city planner, not an urbanologist. I don't want today to suggest specific programs for the city. But I do want to suggest that unless we are radical in the way we go about building up community participation, grassroots organizations, neighborhood groups, neighborhood opportunity centers, neighborhood development units, unless we find the ways of giving to the city its voice, the 400 programs of state and national government for the solution of the urban crisis, the billions of dollars that we are spending to solve the urban crisis will be a band-aid. It will cover the wound, but in no way begin to cure it. Because the people will not feel that they are part of the proposed solution. They have been imposed upon. They are not being consulted. Institutions are being created for them rather than they being partners in the institution. Our Bible did not know the modern city. Scripture knew a city of a different order and a different kind. But with its insight, the Bible does suggest to us, I believe, the state of mind with which we must approach the urban problem. There's only one command for man vis-a-vis the city. Seek ye the peace of the city. We're not told to seek new buildings for the city. We're not told to seek new mass transportation schemes for the city. It's assumed that the technical, the engineering will take care of itself. But we're told to seek the peace of the city. Work with people. Retool ourselves. Look at the human problem and come up with partnership solutions for it. There's an old midrash with which I close. It's a story of a man who left a will. And in that will, he left all his money to his son, provided his son became a fool. Now, the judges who were responsible for this will in probate didn't know what to do with it. And so they went to the most learned scholar in the whole country. And as they approached his house, they found the scholar on the front lawn, down on his hands and knees, making goo-goo eyes and noises of all kinds at his four-year-old grandson. They hid in the bushes so that the jurist wouldn't be embarrassed by being caught in this position. And finally, the grandson and his grandfather went in the house, and they knocked on the door. They were ushered in to his study, and they presented to this most learned of all jurists their problem, what to do with a will in which a man left all of his money to his son, provided his son became a fool. And the jurist just laughed. Well, he said, whenever we love, we become fools. Whenever we share our emotions with another, we're turning off reason, feeling, and concern. Whenever we play with a child, we act foolishly. But the child needs our love, and we need the child's love. And without such folly, without such empathy, without an awareness of people, families do not bind themselves tight. Children do not grow to feel and to care. The world does not move on, progress. I'm speaking this morning in praise of a folly. I'm asking us to go beyond all of the expertise, and it's all necessary, all of the layers of blueprints and plans and architectural drawings. Work with people. And think of people-oriented programs, of listening and of caring. 6 weeks ago, the Cleveland Museum of Art had a large display put on by the AIA, the Architectural Institute, of designs for Cleveland 25 years from now. These were lovely designs of buildings and green spaces and an airport and the lake and all the other things which probably will come about. But I confess the only thing that moved me in this entire exhibit was one wall of pictures, not made by the architects, but by elementary school children from the city of Cleveland. What a city was to them now. These are the children. These are the city. These are the people whom we should be listening to, they and their parents. We must learn to feel and to relate, to care, and to be partners. The buildings will be built. Welfare will be updated and reformed. Schools will be revised. But ultimately, the solution to the crisis in our city lies in a solution to a human problem. It's a far more complicated problem. But this, I believe, is the priority. And if this be folly, let us all be such fools. Amen.